Okay. So Purim is on the mind to some degree at this point, but we already passed Purim Katan, and Rosh Chodesh Adar Sheni is approaching, so it's time for us to think about Purim a little bit. The first minhag of Purim I want to discuss is actually pre-Purim, which is the Zecher Machzis HaShekel, which is something which is done. Women don't always notice it being done because it's done in shul, but it is done, and women, the minhag is women do it as well, or men do it for women. But the just to start from the beginning, and we read in last week's parsha in Kisisa, there's a halacha called Machzis HaShekel, that every year in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, every Jewish male would have to give in a half shekel to the Beis HaMikdash. The chiyuv of Machzis HaShekel, it was really there to pay for the communal karbanos. It was very similar to shul dues, basically. These were our dues to Beis HaMikdash. It was from that money that all of the different karbanos tzibur were bought. The karban tamid, and the ketores, and the musafin, they're all from this money. So every single part of Klal Yisrael, everybody had their stake in the karbanos tzibur, and that was given in through Machzis HaShekel. In the parsha last week in Kisisa, it also mentioned it as a tool for counting Klal Yisrael. That was done mainly in Moshe Rabbeinu's times. Klal Yisrael was counted in other ways throughout history. There is a din not to count Jews by number, so that's why they're given an item. The anytime Jews were counted by number in the Tanakh was always a problem. Hashem punished us for that. I guess just as an aside, many discuss why it's bad to count Jews by number. And one reason given, I believe this is the, I think it's the Barbanel who says this, if I'm remembering correctly, is that, you know, when we're seen as part of the Tzibur, so the Tzibur has a big schus. Even though I might have my problems and my shortcomings, but someone else can complete those shortcomings. So maybe, you know, I'm not so great in chesed, but someone else is. You know, my davening's, you know, good, someone else's is not. My Shmir Shabbos is pretty good, someone else's is not. This person's kashrus is good, mine is not. Everyone kind of completes each other. And as a tzibur, Klal Yisrael has a certain shleimus, a perfection, and as a tzibur. As soon as you're broken up into an individual, so then Hashem scrutinizes you as a person. And none of us as people really have a full schus to show. You know, we all have our own merits, we all have our own shortcomings. And when Hashem scrutinizes us individually with our deeds, so then Hashem sees our shortcomings, you know, coming out much more pronounced. And then Chas V'Shalom, that could lead to bad things. So therefore, Machzis HaShekel teaches us that if you count Jews by number and single them out, that leads to bad things, that leads to scrutiny, that means the Midas HaDin. If we remain part of the Tzibur, that gives us a great schus. So Machzis HaShekel, we'll talk more about it, the fact that it's a half shekel, that indicates that there's another half of me. I'm not on my own. I'm not independent. There's somebody else. There's something else to complete me. And that's the whole concept of it, that I'm part of a tzibur. On my own, I'm lacking. As part of a tzibur, I'm complete. So that's Machzis HaShekel. And that's in the Din D'oraisa, the way it was done in the times of the Beis HaMikdash, was a yearly Machzis HaShekel to the Beis HaMikdash. Nowadays, we don't have that mitzvah because there's no Beis HaMikdash, there's no karbanos. However, nowadays there is a minhag to give a zecher Machzis HaShekel. So we give a half shekel to tzedakah, or a half, we'll see what we give, a half of something to tzedakah, and that's meant to be a zecher, just a way to remember this mitzvah. And that's a minhag, it's not a chiyuv, it's a minhag. The minhag is to use half of your local currency. So in America we use half dollars. Now, if you were in England, you would use, I guess, half, you know, whatever these pounds or whatever. You know, in every country, in Israel, you use about half of a modern shekel, an Israeli shekel. But the minhag is to use a half of the local currency. The minhag is actually to give three coins. So in America, you give three half dollars. That's the minhag. That minhag comes from the fact that when the pasuk talks about Machzis HaShekel, it says the word truma three times. The truma is a donation. So because it says it three times, so we donate three times the value. It's a machlokus, who should participate in this zecher, in this minhag. Some say that this minhag is for men over 20, because that was the chiyuv in the times of Beis HaMikdash. Some say men over 13 or bar mitzvah. But the Mishnah Berurah says the minhag Yisrael is actually that everybody gives. Men, women, children, even give it for katanim and katanos. So people give the Machzis HaShekel for their entire family. And that's the minhag we have nowadays. So you'll see in shul that when people give Machzis HaShekel, so they'll go up there and they'll start giving three half dollars on behalf of every family member. So it could end up being expensive, a big family, it keeps on adding up, you know, but it doesn't get too much, but it adds up there. So that's the Zecher Machzis HaShekel. The reason, I think, the reason that the minhag has developed is given on behalf of everybody is because the pasuk says, l'chaper nachshoseichem, that the machzah shekel itself serves as a kapara for us. So even though we're only doing a zecher, it's not the real thing, it's just a memory of it, it's just a remembrance of it. Even so, we want everyone to get that schus. The idea of it being mechaper for us as an atonement is because the idea of karbanos was for atonement, that's number one. But additionally, as we said, the idea of machzah shekel is to promote achdus. Machzah shekel is something which shows I'm part of a klal, I'm part of a tzibur. And like we said, being that it's a half, half means there's another half out there. I'm incomplete on my own, there's another half to complete me. I, as an individual, am incomplete. And therefore, that creates a kapara for us, because as soon as we associate with the tzibur, we have a lot of schus. Anybody who's on their own is taking a risk. If you're part of the tzibur, you have a big schus. You can extend this, I think, to just to regular everyday life for a second. The people who are involved in communal needs, in Sarche Tzibur, they get tremendous schus. Now, many of, let's say, the Sfar and Bali Musar discuss, what is a schus that we can all achieve for Yom Nerayim? Now, in Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we stand there for the din from Hashem. So one tremendous schus are those who are involved in Sarche Tzibur. They get a the schus the entire tzibur, because everybody's counting on them. So besides the fact we complete each other, now if somebody's involved in Sarche Tzibur, and Hashem says, well, this person really deserves X, but Hashem has to take into account the 500 people that rely upon you. So if I punish this person, then 500 people are going to be, you know, hurt in some way, lacking in some way. So therefore, Hashem has to cheshbin in the entire schus of the whole tzibur to decide to punish this person. So that schus of Sarche Tzibur is tremendous. So when you give a machzah shekel and you associate yourself with the tzibur, you're building up in yourself the schus of the rabbim, which is a tremendous schus. So again, unfortunately, we can't do this nowadays, but what we can do is make a zecher. We give the zecher. So we give our half shekels at tzedakah, and we hope that that should be a schus for us, that it should achieve kapara and help us do the mitzvah in the real way, in the Beis HaMikdash. But this is the special schus of the tzibur. I think this is a very appropriate introduction to Purim. Now, the minhag to do it, there's different minhagim when to do this. Some say do it on Tainus Esther by Mincha. Some say do it on Purim morning. There's different times that are brought down. You know, all times are fine. Different minhagim when to do it. But this really serves sort of as our first step into Purim. This is kind of the mitzvah done, the minhag done right before Purim. And I think, you know, Purim has a big theme of achdus as well. If we look at the machzah shekel as a mitzvah which helps associate the tzibur, if you look at the story of Purim, a lot has to do with Klai Yisrael coming together as one. And just to start for a second, we know Haman comes into Achashverosh, and Haman makes the claim. He says that there's Am Mefuzar and Mefora bin Ha'amim. There's a nation which is scattered and spread out amongst all your nations. So many of the Mefarshim say it's not just a geographical explanation. The fact that we're scattered and spread out is describing us. We were Mefuzar as people. We weren't bonding. We didn't have Achdus. Klai Yisrael was infighting. There was tension. There were splits in Klai Yisrael. And Haman was a smart man. Haman knew how to accuse us of the wrongdoing, and he was right. And we were. There was sin in Klai Yisrael. So if that was part of Haman's taina to kill us, we had to fix that problem to be saved. So what does Esther do? So Esther says to Mordechai, I'm willing to go into the Achashverosh and plead the case. But if she says, Lech Kenos Kol Yehudim, gather together all the Jews. And Farshim say that Esther was saying, bring them together with Achdus. They should come together as one, unity. Create that unity amongst Klal Yisrael. Because Haman claimed correctly that we were scattered and we were splintered and we were split up amongst the entire nations. So Mordechai, go out there and create Achdus. Have Klal Yisrael bond together as one. And then with that schus, I can enter into Achashverosh. Without that schus, though, I have nothing I can do. Because as long as we are split and we're fighting, Hashem's not going to save us. So Esther understood that. Later on in the Megillah, we know the mitzvahs that we have, Matanos Levyonim, Shalach Manis, those mitzvahs create achdus, which create friendship amongst Jews. Shalach Manis, many say the main goal of Shalach Manis is to increase friendship, it's to increase reyus amongst Jews, because the mitzvahs of Purim create unity. The Purim is a day where we do feel unity, we kind of feel all together as one, we feel the simcha together. So Purim really is a yantif, which is pointing towards unity. Haman recognized that we were split, we were misakin that with our tshuva, and we came together. And therefore, machsa shekel, which also represents unity, is a very, very important mitzvah to bring us into Purim. In the times of the Beis HaMikdash, the machsa shekel itself was done during the month of Adar, which is why we do it now. So it says, "Bechodesh Adar machrizin al shkalim." In Adar, they start announcing to the nation to bring in their shkalim. The reason for that was because Nisan was when they would purchase the new karbanos, they had to have all the money before Nisan. So Adar was the month for this, which is why we do it in Adar. But it very much fits the theme of Purim. This idea of Achlus and Purim, really, we could talk about much more at length, not for today's shir, but Purim really is a yontif which focuses a lot on Achlus of Klal Yisrael. It's a very important point about Purim. One more deeper point about the Machsa Shekel and why it's relevant to Purim is the Gemara says that, you know, Haman came into Achashverosh, and Haman offered money to order to buy off the Jews, basically. He came in and he says, I'll give you a saras alafim kikar kesef, you know, a large amount of money to purchase the rights to kill Klal Yisrael. Achashverosh didn't need him. Achashverosh, who was a wealthy king and also hated Jews, said, you can keep the money anyways, don't worry about it. And killed him too. You know, the Achashverosh didn't care. But Haman came in with his shkalim. The Gemara says that we have to meet makdim shekalinu l'shutkul shalham. We have to be able to show that our shekel precedes Haman's shekel. So we have the machsa shekel as our schus, and we make sure we pay that off in terms of the mitzvah to the Beis HaMikdash prior to Haman offering his shekel to Achashverosh. So that's the words of Chazal. So there's a connection between Haman's offering of money and our mitzvah machsa shekel. So I once heard a shir from Ramos Shapiro who sort of explained that in a much deeper way. And he said, and I'm going to summarize, but he said that the idea of machsa shekel is that machsa shekel indicates to us what our true values are. And let me explain that for a second. Now, every single country has a currency. And currency is how much we use to evaluate prices. A price is the value of an item. Something that's worth, you know, a dollar, it means it's not worth all that much to me. If it's worth $10,000, that means that it's something I value more. It has more value, it's more important, I value it more, I'm willing to pay more for it. I'm only willing to part with the money based on the value of the item. So if an item to me has a lot of value, then I pay a lot of money for it. If not, then I don't. The machsa shekel, it says that there's a medrash that says, where's the other half? Now we have a half, right? So it says that Moshe Rabbeinu, for some reason, was confused about machsa shekel. He didn't know how to do it. Now that's just a funny thing to say because it's just a coin. Like, I don't know what was so hard about it. But Moshe Rabbeinu was niskashi. He was confused about machsa shekel. So it says Hashem showed to him a mabeya shel ish, a golden coin. So Moshe could see what kind of coin we're talking about. So where's the other half of the shekel? We have half. The other half is Hashem's half. And it's the mabeya shel ish, tachzis ha'kavod. There's this fiery currency that Hashem has under his kisei hakavod, and that's where the other half machsa shekel. So Moshe Shapiro Zatzal, what he said was that, you know, in every country, when you have a coin, there's going to be what do you call it? There's going to be like the standard. We don't have it anymore. In America, it used to be every single dollar had a silver bar backing it, a silver certificate, right? We know that when it comes to like measurements, it used to be there was the official measurement somewhere in a vault. Nowadays they do it all, I think, atomically and stuff. But it used to be there was an official the official meter somewhere in a vault somewhere in Europe, and that was the official meter. And from that, everything else is evaluated. You know, so every currency, the king, he's the one who mints the currency. He's the one who decides what the currency is all about. He gives it value, and then that's given out to the nation. So the currency of machsa shekel, it shows us that the greatest value, the way we evaluate things, the way that we give value to what's around us is based on Hashem's standards. Hashem's is the golden standard, as it were. That's machsa shekel. So by Hashem's standards, Klal Yisrael is priceless. You know, it says, "Mitan ish is kol hum beso ba'ava." If somebody would give all of his wealth to buy off the love of Hashem to Klal Yisrael, bozi avuzulo, you disgrace the person. It's ridiculous. We're priceless. So in terms of Hashem's currency, you know, mitzvahs have value. Torah has value, Chesed has value, Tefillah has value, and these things have very high values, and you can't buy off Klal Yisrael. Like it says, now you give all the money in the world, you can't buy off Klal Yisrael. Haman, though, had a different value system. Haman said, okay, you know, Jews, I'll give you 10,000 kikar kesef, and I'll kill off all the Jews. And Achashverosh says, no, they're free. You know, buy one, get one free today. It's a sale. And you can have as many Jews as you want. It's all free. So we see that what they valued. You know, they valued Jews as worthless. And you know, they valued, you know, Achashverosh's great parties, you know, his palace, his beautiful rugs, his silver beds and golden couches and silver goblets. That was their values. And Purim is this clash of what's truly valuable in life. You know, we have our value system, they have their value system. So when we are makdim our shekel to Haman's shekel, what we're showing is that Haman, you think that you could put a price on Klal Yisrael's head. You think that your value system is real. You got it all wrong. Our value system is created by Hashem. Our value system is absolute. Klal Yisrael is priceless. What you think is valuable is not valuable. And that's why our mitzvah of Shkolim has to come before Haman Shekel. So we have to set our value straight. But that's what Moshe Shapiro explained. Just to expand upon that for 1 second, this also is a very major theme of Purim. Because Purim is all about the fact that things that we see in life that we think are real are not real. You know, we think Haman is really powerful. We think he's really a threat. He wasn't a threat and he wasn't powerful. You know, we think that those gallows are there to hang Mordechai. It wasn't really. It was there to hang Haman. You know, we think that all this, Haman's great estate is his wealth. No, that wealth all went to Mordechai and Esther. And it means the things you think in life are totally real. You know, they're really just a mirage sometimes. No, they're not real. You know, we think this is valuable. It's not valuable. It's just that our value system is corrupt. So therefore, we think it's valuable and it's not. But it's all fantasy. It's all mirage. Amalek. You know, Haman comes from Amalek, and Amalek the Chazal tell us is referred to as a letz. Now, the idea of a letz or letzanus. So we translate that. You know, in modern Hebrew, a clown is a letzan, which is not really the best translation in terms of the Tanakh. But it's a clown's a letzan. But a letz is someone who, I would call him more of a cynic. Someone who looks at everything around and won't ever accept it as valuable or as important. Anything he sees, he pokes a hole in, makes a joke out of. A letz is somebody, you know, he ridicules all that's around, he's cynical, he's a scoffer, he's sarcastic, but nothing is ever given any significance. And Amalek is a nation which are called Leitzanim. They see nothing in this world has any significance. Hashem, we can deal with him. Torah, forget about it. Klal Yisrael, you know, they're free, kill them all out. Nothing is meaningful to them. And that was Haman's attitude. Haman's attitude was, there's nothing's important besides me. That's all he thought. Just, you know, his own power, his own money, that's all he cared about. Nothing else in the world had any value. And Amalek are those who have this power. The Rav Huttner calls it the Koach HaBittel. They see things that are important and they're mevatel. They just brush it off as insignificant. So the idea of Machsa Shekel is to teach us a lesson about Purim. We're supposed to understand that there are things in the world that have value. That value is evaluated based on Hashem's value system, and that's real value. And everything else is not the right value system. You're not evaluating things properly. You're putting the wrong price tag on things. And that's a lesson of Purim. We say, Ein aruch l'cha Hashem, Ein aruch k'Hashem l'keinu. There's nothing as valuable as Hashem. That's the idea. We're in a world where we make value judgments. We have to know what the most valuable things are and what they're not so valuable. And Purim is there to teach us a lesson of what's valuable, what's not valuable. So that's Machsa Shekel. So moving on a little bit into Purim itself, I guess in no particular order, I want to start with Kriyas Megillah. The minhag is brought down that you should wear Big Day Shabbos to Kriyas Megillah. It's something which, you know, some people do. Some people more casual in Purim, they put on costume. But for Kriyas Megillah, the minhag is brought down that you should wear Big Day Shabbos. If you want to get into costumes and more casual things, you do afterwards. But you know, it's a Yom Tov, and it's based on a pasuk. The pasuk says that Purim is a Simcha u'Mishta v'Yom Tov. There's Simcha, there's Mishta, there's party, and there's Yom Tov. It's like Yom Tov. So being that it's like Yom Tov, you want to dress up in your finest clothes, and you should go to shul on Purim in Big Day Shabbos. The Megillah itself, there's a lot of minhagim about the Megillah, just things to mention a few that maybe we notice as we hear it read. The Megillah, there's a minute to fold it up like a letter. Now, we're not familiar with these old time, like, you know, letters that the kings would send with their messengers, and they'd have this guy reading them out like this. But if you notice, the Balkore, prior to Kriyas Megillah, he takes the Megillah and he starts folding it on its back and forth. You ever notice that? So you can watch in shul this year, but they unroll the whole thing, And then instead of just reading it like a Torah, where you roll it as you read, they kind of fold it like a letter. And then it's kind of like, you know, you have the king's man there, like announcing, making a royal announcement, kind of. You know, it's supposed to be folded like an igeris, like a letter. And that's because the Megillah is called an igeris. It's called a letter. That's what it's called in the Megillah itself. So we actually have a minog to fold it up like they would read a letter in the old days. And that's how it's still laying. It's folded up like a letter. The idea of a letter is that we have to understand the whole Nes of Purim. It wasn't something anybody noticed at the time. Because the Nes of Purim was Nes Nister. It was all hidden. There's no single event in the Megillah which is miraculous. Every pasuk on its own is just a regular, everyday idea. You know, there was a king, and he made a party, and he had lots of wine, and then he got upset, and he killed off his wife. That was normal in those days, you know. Found another wife, and there's nothing there. This crazy guy's promoted to power, and he wanted to kill other people. But these were normal. These aren't anything too different in the history of monarchs. But when it came all together, people realized, hey, this is a big nace. So Mordechai and Esther, when they compiled the Megillah and they wrote it, Baruch HaKodesh, they wrote it as a letter, seemingly to Klal Yisrael, to teach them, look what just happened. You guys don't realize the incredible nes you just experienced. So you end up in your town, someone came in with these letters from the royal palace. And it was telling the whole story and teaching them that these events which occurred, which they thought were just kind of everyday news events in politics or something, these are actually a tremendous nes from Hashem. That was the lesson of the Megillah. So the Megillah is folded like a letter to sort of resemble that, you know, that reality in those days, that it was a letter written to Klal Yisrael to teach them about this. There's a minhag, which during the Kriyas Megillah, there's four psukim we read out loud ourselves, right? Ish Yehudi, Mordechai Yatza, Lihudim Haisa Orva Simcha, and Ki Mordechai Yehudi. So there's a minhag; those four psukim read out loud in shul. So the question is why, and there's no strong source as to why those are read out loud. It is the minhag, but the explanations are given. One explanation simply is to increase simcha. It's kind of exciting to read these out. These are happy psukim, exciting psukim, and you know, it's more fun to read them out loud. I mean, we do things sometimes on Purim to increase our simcha. Purim is a day of simcha. Now, one other explanation given is that you read this psukim out loud so nobody falls asleep. You know, it kind of wakes you up if you're kind of dozing off. Morcha yatza, you know, and you start reading it out loud. My question on that is, if that was the case, you should probably more evenly scatter them throughout the Megillah. You know, these psukim, one's in the beginning and the three are at the end. There's nothing in the middle that you read out loud. So if it's to keep you awake, I would think you should kind of put one in every single parak to kind of like, you know, wake up the crowd or something. But there are the mafarshim that say, read them out loud to wake up those who are starting to nod off. And these psukim were chosen because these psukim all speak about the covet of Mordechai. The Mordechai and Esther, but Mordechai is the hero of our story. So the first pasuk is Ish Yehudi. It's the first intro to Mordechai. Mordechai Yatzav Ne'amelech talks about Mordechai leaving the king's presence, you know, wearing all the royal garments. And Mahirumas Erva Simcha talks about the Jews as a whole celebrating. And Ki Mordechai HaYehudi, the last pasuk we read, talks about Mordechai's power. So these psukim, they speak mostly about Mordechai and his kavod. So we read these psukim out loud. So bottom line, there's not any great, you know, source or reason why we do this, but the minhag is to do it, and we should do it. The other thing read out loud is interesting is the 10 sons of Haman. We read out loud also. You know, the Balkore pauses, we say it out loud, and then he goes back and he lanes them. So the question is, why is that? So first, before we get to why we read out loud, the minhag is that the Balkore, as we know, reads it in one breath. Right? It's a lot of these long, you know, interesting Persian names, and he has to read it all quickly in one breath. So the reason they brought down for that is in order to show that they were all hanged together at once on the gallows. So it was like a simultaneous hanging, and I guess they pulled the ropes all at once, and all 10 of them were killed at once. So therefore he reads it all together in one breath to show it all happened at the same time. That's why we do it. But why does he pause for us to read it first is the question. So some did not have that minhag, but the minhag seems to have become that everyone does it this way. So the reason is why. So I saw a few reasons for this. Number one is the Aruch HaShulchan says that this is the Iker Yeshua. The death of Haman's sons is the Iker salvation. He doesn't explain much more than that. I suppose what he means is that even if Haman is dead, if his sons are still alive, he has 10 of them, and they're all as bad as him, then we still have an enemy to fight. I guess once they're killed out, that means we've taken away Haman's family, and therefore it's, you know, everything else after. It's like when you kill the general of the army, the rest of it's pretty easy afterwards. So I guess that's what he means. The Ktsos HaShulchan, he says an interesting thing. He says that used to be that kids would clap, like you clap for Haman, they would clap for all of the 10 sons of Haman. So they'd say, Asparshadasa, you know, Aspasa, and every single one of the kids they would clap for. So the problem is, though, if the Chazan's saying it all in one breath, then you got a problem. He can't pause, right? So kids are clapping, and the Chazan's trying to get through one breath, and either he's going to pass out, or no one's going to hear those names. So the minhag developed that you would read them first, you know, the Sibur reads them first, the kids can clap while the Sibur reads them, and then after the fact, the Chazan can read it all straight through, and nobody claps. That's the Chazan's Shulchan's reason. There's one other reason given, which is a more of a halachic reason, Safnas Paneach. He says that the being that there's a halacha, it's read them all in one breath. So halachically, when the way we're yotzei through Megillah is called Shemei Ka'ona. You know, we listen, and listening is like we recited it. That's the mitzvah. So even though, you know, all of us have a chiyuv to hear the Megillah, but I'm not reading it. But the fact is that being that I'm listening, I'm Shemei Ka'ona. So I can do that for words, but there's also halacha to say these 10 names in one breath. Well, how can his one breath be my one breath? I can listen to him read, and it's like I'm reading. That's a halacha that we know. But his lack of breathing cannot become my lack of breathing. I mean, how does that work? So he says that the reason we read it out loud to ourselves is so we can actually do it all in one breath also, and be yotzei that halacha. So, which means that when we do it, we should do it in one breath. That's what that means. Maybe we should practice in advance a little bit to get all those names down. You know, but according to Safnas Paneach, we should be reading it all in one breath ourselves. So that's as opposed to the other explanation we gave, that you don't have to. But according to him, you'd have to do it all in one breath yourself. So I guess it's best if you can... turn my phone off, I'm sorry. It's best if you can do it that way. Best if you can do it that way. So that's the idea of the Seres Bnei Haman. We now know the famous minhag to make noise when Haman's name is said, right? So where does that come from? So it actually begins, the Ramah says that there was a minhag initially that people would write the name of Haman or draw a picture of Haman on sticks and stones, and then they would whack them together like this, and that would symbolize the erasing Haman's name. You know, there's a din, there's a halacha, there's a mitzvah deraisa. They're supposed to erase the name of Malik. Haman's a Malik. It says there's a din of Timcha Zechra Malchus Mitach Hashemayim. They're supposed to erase a Malik from under the heavens. So people would symbolically, you know, draw a little picture of Haman on a stone or write his name and then start like whacking them together, and that was like erasing Haman. So from that developed the, and that's based on the idea of erasing a Malik. And also, there's a pasuk Shem Rishayim Yerkov, that the name of the wicked should rot. So you're going to take Haman's name and kind of like rot his name and smack his name. From this, the minhag developed to start clapping in shul when they said his name. That's what the Rama says. The problem always is that you have to make sure you hear all the words too. So you have lots of halachic literature about how people have to get the kids to be quiet and the chazan has to wait. So everyone hears all the words. As we know, the shul can be a little bit rowdy sometimes when during Haman. But then minhag comes from the fact that it's erased Haman's name. Now, as a related point, it's interesting. It's brought down that the Rebbe Reb Heschel, when he was doing Safras, he was trying to test out his ink to see if it's good ink or not. So he would always write the name of Malik or Haman, test it out, because once he tested it out, he would erase it afterwards. And it gave him an opportunity to erase a Malik. So when he was just writing to test it out, he would write a Malik and then erase a Malik and do a mitzvah. So so he was mekayem the idea of Machu Emcha Zechra Malta Chashemayim. Interesting thing. The Chasam Sofer, so he says a little different point. He says that a Malik needs to be forgotten. You know, we're supposed to forget a Malik. On the other hand, we're not supposed to forget what Malik did to us. So there's always this like tension. It's supposed to erase the Malik, but remember what they did to us. So when we have to lay in the Megillah, we're supposed to talk about Haman. But we also don't want to talk about Haman because he's a Malik. So what we do is we start making noise to show that I'd rather not be listening about Haman, but I have to because it's the mitzvah of the Megillah. So when I hear his name, I'm going to start making noise and obliterate his name. So it's kind of like resolving that tension. Because it is an interesting thing in terms of the mitzvah. It says, Timcha Zechra Malik, erase the memory of a Malik. But also says, Lo Sishkach, don't forget what a Malik did to you. So there's this sort of halachic-like tension about erasing Amalek, but not forgetting about Amalek. Both. So when we say Haman, then we start blotting out his name. So that itself is kind of resolving that tension. We're saying we have to mention it, but we're going to immediately start erasing it. There's a fascinating Medrash Eliyahu, it's called, which I think is one of these lesser known Midrashim. But it says that when we say the idea of Arar Haman, Haman should be cursed, or when we clap Haman's name, make noise when he's being mentioned, so Hashem has that Haman still feels the pain to this very day. Haman, I guess, in Gehenna is feeling that pain. Why? Because if he was successful, none of us would be here. So really, because he would have destroyed all the Jews. So every single one of us still owes it to Haman to cause him pain, because he threatened all of our lives. So when we hear Haman's name, we start making noise. Or when we say Arar Haman, like we do in Shushan Siakov, we say Arar Haman Baruch Mordechai, Haman still feels pain from that. So the more you clap out Haman's name, you're actually causing Haman pain currently, in his current state. And we try to give him this pain to this very day. Interesting thing. The a related point, the Aruch, one of the early Rishonim, he says that there was a minhag in his days that they would make a Haman like dummy. Yeah, some sort of effigy of Haman. And they would leave it around before Purim for 4 or 5 days, like on the roof or something. And then when Purim came, they would take it and they would burn it in a fire on Purim. And that was also this idea of trying to, I mean, it sounds just like Purim shtick, but also the idea of trying to erase, symbolically erasing Haman, erasing Amalek. That was this idea. The way that we nowadays, we have a minhag to use groggers to make noise. I mean, the minhag was just to make noise. Just, make some sort of noise, clap, stamp, whatever it was. The idea of a grogger is something which developed as the minhag. This is the tool we use in order to create this noise. So where does that come from? So the idea of the grogger is, we mentioned this actually, I think, Hanukkah time. The idea of the grogger. The grogger is this, the grogger you traditionally spin from the bottom, and the dreidel is from the top. So those who remember, we mentioned this, I think, a few months ago. The miracle of Hanukkah was started from above. It was called Yitzrusa de Le'ela. Hashem started from above. It was a nes which was supernatural, and therefore you spin the dreidel from above. The nes of Purim started from us. The nes of Purim began because Esther said, fast, do tshuva. It started from down below, from our ends. Therefore, we spin the grogger from the bottom to symbolize the concept of what we call Isarusa de la Tassa, the fact that things were initiated from our end, from our end of the stick. And then that's the grogger. So, I don't know historically when groggers began. It is mentioned in probably the past few hundred years, but certainly there's this symbolism that it was our initiative, it was our doing that caused the Nisav Purim, and therefore we have it spinning from the bottom. So, again, Minhag Yisrael is Torah, and even though these things seem like they're arbitrary or silly, the Minhag Yisrael has value to it. The idea of costumes is an interesting idea. Actually, one more thing, Megillah first. We'll talk about one thing. We're still in the Megillah. I don't want to move on from Megillah yet. Here it is. Okay, sorry. When laying the Megillah, so there is a... there are different places in the Megillah that the Baal Kore is supposed to say them out loud. I mean, like louder. Like he raises his voice. He always says that loud, but he raises his voice. So one of the famous places is it says, "B'laylahu narda shnas hamelech." On that night, the sleep of the king was, he was unsettled, he wasn't falling asleep. So there's a minug that the Baal Kore at that point, he raises his voice louder and says it to like a niggin. Some do a niggin like hamelech, like from Yom Narayim, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur type niggin. But there's a minhag at that point that you raise your voice and you sing it like a special niggun, something like that. So the question is, why at that point do we sort of change the tune and raise our voice? So it's explained that there the main part of the nes really began. And the way we understand that is that if you look at the Megillah, you can actually chart it out, let's call it. If you were to take Haman's Haman's greatness, Haman begins here, he goes up, and he goes down. Right? Mordechai and Esther and the Klai Yisrael begin here, we go down, and then we go up. Right? That's the chart of the Megillah. So when's that turning point? So that turning point really is Narda Shnas HaMelech. At that moment, when Achashverosh couldn't sleep, And he has to read over his royal chronicles to figure out, you know, what did I forget to do? Why am I not sleeping? He figures out he forgot to reward Mordechai. That moment was the moment where everything changed. And just elaborate on that for 1 second. There's a story there which seems to be totally irrelevant. I mean, every part of the Megillah is part of the Nes. The Vilna Gaon says that there's no pasuk in the Megillah that does not somehow contribute to the Nes. Every pasuk is part of the Nes. But if you read through the story, it's cute when Haman leads around Mordechai on the horse. It's very cute that Achashverosh forgot to reward Mordechai for saving his life, and I want to reward him. But what's the purpose of that story there? And the truth is, let's get my Megillah for 1 second. The truth is, I think you see there in that parak of the Megillah a few psukim which totally show the entire story flipping around. Find it. So this is parak vav of the Megillah. So it says, "B'layla hu norash ha-simelch." So Perek Vav begins, then that night, the sleep of the king was unsettled. He wasn't able to sleep. So Achashverosh said, "Bring me my royal chronicles and read them to me. And I want to see, like, you know, there must be something in there that I forgot to do. You know, this will help me get settled." And they found out he didn't reward Mordechai. So at that very moment, Achashverosh says, I need to reward Mordechai. Who's out there who can help me figure out what to do for him? And Haman's out in the chatzer coming in to tell him, I want to kill Mordechai. So you have here what I call the biggest Purim joke of it all, right? And there's two psukim, and the contrast is that the world's apart. It says, V'imra melech manasseh yakar gdul Mordechai ozeh. The melech said, well, has Mordechai been given any honor or any greatness for saving my life? And the king's servant said, no, Mordechai wasn't yet rewarded. So it says, so he says, who's in the courtyard? And Haman was there in the outer courtyard of the melech to tell the melech to hang Mordechai on the gallows he prepared for him. And the king said, Haman should come in. So you have here the clash right now. Haman's about there to say, let's kill Mordechai. And Achashverosh says, how can I reward Mordechai? Haman comes in thinking he's there to kill him. He walks out going to lead him around the horse and reward him. This is the turning point in the whole Megillah right now. This is where we said that Haman's going up and down. Right here he goes, starts going down. Right, he's reached the top and starts going down. Mordechai went down. At this point, he's going to start going up. And this story of Haman and Mordechai being led around the horse by Haman, this is when the entire story flips in favor of Klal Yisrael. This is the turning point of the entire Megillah. I think it's Ibn Ezra, I think, says this. Ibn Ezra says, no, Esther had two parties. She invited Achashverosh to party number one in Haman. Achashverosh said, what can I do for you? And Esther said, come to my party again tomorrow. Very strange. Why'd she make two parties? And you know, the Gemara goes through a lot of reasons why she wanted to make two parties, but it's a very funny thing. Why couldn't she just request the first party that Haman be killed? But why did she wait to the second party to accuse Haman? So again, I think it's the Ibn Ezra who says that Esther was awaiting a sign from Shemayim that Hashem has now accepted our tshuva and come to our side. Until this point, Klal Yisrael, you know, we were guilty. And Hashem, Kevayachol, was siding with Haman. And he was ready to let Haman kill us. Esther said, I can't request that Haman be killed until I know Hashem's on our side. She's waiting for a sign. When she saw Mordechai on the horse being led by Haman, she said, that's it. I have my sign. I know now that Haman is going to fall and Mordechai is going to rise. Now I can request Haman being killed. Now I can accuse him. That was the moment. So this whole little story here, it's a very cute story. The image of Mordechai on the horse led by Haman is one of these little cute images you see in all the children's books. But this is the turning point, because this is when Haman's path starts going down, Mordechai starts going up, and everything changes. This is this point. So the fact that now the Balquiri stops and says, he's there to indicate to us, you've reached the Iker point of the Nes. Now you're going to see the Nes really is starting to unfold before your eyes, you know, very quickly from here on out. And that point in the Megillah is a very, very important transition point where everything changes. Beyond that, There are several other places where the Balkuri has a minhag to lean the psukim out loud or to a different niggin. So often we hear the Megillah and we think he's doing shtick or something. But these are actual minhagim as to when he's supposed to sort of raise his voice and say a little different tune. So there are the places where minhag to say Eichatun. Now those we know fairly well. You know, each one of those places refers to the Chorban, or refers to, you know, the Klai Yisrael still at risk of being killed. So that's like the such as ideas of, let's say, Vekeli, Mikeli, Mishonim. That's a remiss to that Achashverosh used the Kilim of Beis Hamikdash for his party. So that refers to the Chorban. It says, you know, Mordechai was sent to Galus, Asher Haglam, Yerushalayim, Asher Magol, Asher Haglas, so he was sent to Galus with the Chorban. So we lean down Eichatun. See, those places where we lean the Eichatun. A few others as well. But beyond that, there are other psukim in the Megillah that the Balkur is supposed to lean out loud, louder, in a different tune. Such as, this is an Elios, Kolish, Sir Beveso, the end of the first parak. You have several others. Each one has its own reason. A few interesting ones. You have a few different psukim that are that encoded in them are the names of Hashem. Now, the Megillah doesn't say Hashem's name anywhere. That's a famous idea. The Megillah never says Hashem, never says Elkim, no Kael, no Shakai. There's no shame. Hashem's not mentioned in the Megillah at all. You'd think it's not a holy book. Where's God in this book? You know, he's not there. So the answer is, well, that's the whole point. Meaning the Megillah is about the hidden miracle, the fact that Hashem is behind the scenes and still running the show. That's what the Megillah is all about. But you do find in the Megillah certain references to Hashem. So for instance, there's a passage like Yavo HaMelech VeHaman Hayom. And the Rosh Tevos, those four words, are Yudke Vavke. So there's a minog to lane those four words in a little louder, different tune, because those words are referenced to Hashem. There's another pasuk, Yavo HaMelech VeHaman El, which is another Shem Vashem. Yud Hey Vav and Aleph is another reference to Hashem Vashem. It says Ki Kalsa Elav Hara'a. The four Sofei Tevos, the last letters of those words are Yudke Vavke, and that's also laying out loud in a different tune. So you have several places where these are actually Ramazim to Hashem himself, and therefore those are laying out loud in a special tune to indicate that. Again, I'm not going through them all, but you'll hear, if you listen closely now to the laning, there are places where the Balkore just lanes a little differently. And it's not just being a shtick, it's because there's a minhag those psukim should be emphasized one way or the other. There's another interesting minhag, which is that we said the Megillah is called an Igeres. So there's a certain point when he lanes, Igeres Hazos, they actually will shake the Megillah, because it's this Igeres. So therefore, you take this letter and you shake it to show this is the Igeres we're talking about. So there are other things as well, but if you notice, there are many different minhagim during Kriyas and Megillah, the tune or the motions, whatever it is, which different Bali Kriya do. And those are all going to have basis in terms of bringing out and emphasizing certain points. So I'm going to get to maybe one more thing, which is the idea of costumes, the idea of Purim costumes. This is actually be a longer talk, but we'll say it in short for now. There's an interesting minhag in Israel, what we wear, costumes of Purim. That's a minhag, there's no obligations, the Megillah does not mention anything about a costume, it's nowhere to be found in terms of any sort of halachic obligation, but it is brought down as a minhag. The Ramah talks about it, it's a minhag Israel to wear costumes. Where does this come from? So the simple reason is because being that Purim is about a hidden miracle, so we hide ourselves. So that's the idea, we're walking in, just like Hashem is hidden in the Megillah, we don't see Hashem out there doing Nisim. It's not like Kriyas Yamsuf, it's not like the Makos, but Hashem is really there behind the scenes performing miracles. So too, we also hide ourselves like Hashem is there. You know, Esther's name is from the term Hester, which is hidden. The Gemara says, where do you find a reference to Esther in the Torah itself? It says, Nochi Haster Aster Panai. Hashem says, I will hide my face. And that's a reference to Esther. So literally, we put on a mask, we hide our faces. Anochi Haster Aster Panai. Esther's hidden, our faces are hidden. That's the idea of a costume. Furthermore, you know, Purim is all about, you know, what you see is not what you get. And like we said before, you know, what is reality? What's fantasy? What's valuable? What's not? You see Haman, and you think you're seeing this like really powerful, serious, you know, ruler, and what you're seeing is a joke. And what you're seeing is dead 3 days later. So what you see is not what you get. affirms about this idea that, you know, you think you see what I really am. You don't really see me either. You know, all of us, you know, we're much more than meets the eye. You think that the physical world you're in is a reality. There's a spiritual world behind it all, which really controls it all. And Purim is all about seeing that what you see in front of your eyes is, you know, the Jews thought they're going to be annihilated. It was all a joke. It wasn't true. Haman thought that he was going to kill all the Jews on Yud Gimel Adar. Haman actually created a Yantif. You know, instead of a day of mourning, Haman created one of the most happy Yantifs of the year. Haman wanted to annihilate all the Jews. Haman was actually a cause for the building of Bayis Sheni. What you see, not what you get. You know, the reality in front of your eyes is not the reality of reality. It's just a facade. It's a joke. It's a fantasy. It's not real. One other point about costumes is something I was thinking about this week. In last week's parsha in Kisisa, you have a very, I don't know, hard to understand those strange few psukim, which are often sort of glossed over and aren't thought about. It says that Moshe Rabbeinu came down from Har Sinai, and his face was glowing. Right, Kikaron or Panav. So, and the people were scared to approach Moshe Rabbeinu because his face was glowing. So Moshe had to put on a mask, a masveh. And we don't even picture it. Moshe Rabbeinu wore that mask the rest of his life, except for when he would teach Torah to Klal Yisrael, or when he would talk to Hashem. But if he was going about his daily activities, he'd be wearing a mask. It's just so strange to us to even think about it. But it's mentioned once in the Torah, it's right here in last week's Parsha. It's given a few psukim. But Moshe Rabbeinu wore a mask because he had this like glow shining from him. And it wasn't right that people should stare at this glow all the time. People were sort of afraid to approach him with the glow, and therefore he would cover himself up. He would only take it off to teach Torah, because, you know, when you're teaching Torah, you want to be able to show the beauty of Torah. People should see the Rebbe. And speaking to Hashem, because when you speak to Hashem, it's not kavodik to be wearing a mask, we talk to Hashem. But besides that, he'd be wearing this mask. So the it's interesting, because where does glow come from? And this glow is something sort of too hard for us to understand exactly where it came from. But the glow, whatever it was, Moshe Rabbeinu was in a very, very holy situation in Har Sinai. He experienced Hashem's, you know, greatness in Har Sinai. And Moshe Rabbeinu came down glowing with the Ziva Shechina. The radiance of the Shechina was glowing from Moshe Rabbeinu's face. The same way that we could say, if you see an Adam Gadol, a great tzaddik or Talmid Chacham, there's a certain glow, hadras panim. So that we even experience nowadays to some degree. Moshe Rabbeinu had it shining, you know, in a way which we can't even imagine. On Yom Kippur, we speak about the Kohen Gadol leaving the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Now we have the famous Piyut Mare Kohen, which talks about, you know, when the Kohen would leave the Kodesh HaKadoshim, he'd be glowing. Like, we give all sorts of different mashals as to what he was glowing like, but he was glowing. Because being in the Kodesh HaKadoshim was an experience that was so holy, you're so close to Hashem, you come out with this spiritual radiance. That didn't last. You know, that was on the Kohen Gadol, seemingly just temporarily. But all the people were able to experience a little miniature of that glow. And I would think it's the same glow that Moshe Rabbeinu had in Har Sinai, the Kohen Gadol got in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. We know Purim has connections to Yom Kippur. The famous quote from the Arizal, that, you know, Yom Kippur is called Yom Kippurim, it's a day like Purim, and Purim is a day compared to Yom Kippur, which again can be its own discussion, you know, why are those 2 days compared? But Purim is a day also where a person can experience really such a depth of spirituality, we could all come out with a glow. And maybe we wear those masks to be able to show, like, we're like Moshe Rabbeinu, that on Purim we're experiencing such a depth of connecting to Klal Yisrael and to Ruchnius and to the spiritual world, that we should all be glowing, and therefore we want to cover the, like Moshe Rabbeinu, because we don't want to expose that glow. Maybe Purim also has a certain sense of that as well, because it's like Yom Kippur, and it's the same power of the Moshe Rabbeinu came down like that after the Klal Yisrael did tshuva from the Chet HaEgel. The tshuva creates this special radiance. Yom Kippur is the day of tshuva. Yom Kippur is the day where Klal Yisrael does tshuva, and we get this, and the Kohen Gadol got this radiance. And Purim is also the day of tshuva. You know, this whole story of Purim is about tshuva. It's about Klal Yisrael recognizing that in order for Hashem to save us, we better fast, we better do tshuva, we better increase our avas Yisrael. And if we can achieve, you know, what Purim has to offer us, we can also have a special glow in Purim. So maybe these masks are also alluding to this idea as well. That's the thought.